This is Farhan Israeli, and I'm here with Heidi Hirvaya, and we're starting a series today on the Bhagavad Gita, so I'm really excited and happy to have you here. And I thought maybe it would be useful for those people who are listening to maybe know a little bit about your background as a yoga teacher and as a student of the Bhagavad Gita.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm also really happy to be here, and it's a great honor. And I've been practicing yoga and meditation for a long time. I was a seeker from probably childhood, really. And so I started asking questions about life and about who I was and about existence and why I suffered and why all adults that I met seemed really, really unhappy. And I had to grow up and become another unhappy adult, and I didn't want any of that to happen to me. So I started looking, and I just kept looking until I found answers. And so pretty early on, I found meditation, and it was something that just felt very natural for me. And it was very easy for me to sit and close my eyes and be in a contemplative space. I had started writing poetry when I was also younger, and so it all kind of went together with that contemplative space that seemed very natural to me at the time. So that's how I started. And then when I graduated from high school, I grew up in Montreal, and I graduated from high school and got accepted to an international school out here on Vancouver Island. And there I got introduced more fully to the philosophy behind meditation. At the same time, we were having Baha'i people coming to our school, and that fascinated me because I was so interested in international understanding, which was the motto of my school, and in people being able to live together in harmony, which was a big ideal of mine. So I was sort of torn between, okay, what path am I going to follow, and am I even going to follow a spiritual path? So I went to Israel, and I lived there for a few months, and somehow my whole spiritual development seemed to accelerate there, and it became really obvious to me that I needed to come back to Canada and just start delving into yogic philosophy and yoga more. It was like a pull. I just felt like a magnetic pull. So I came back to Montreal, and I started attending yoga classes and philosophy classes and satsangs at a center there, and eventually moved into the center, and eventually went to India, and the rest is history. And because I've always been a talker, so it's been very delightful for me to talk about this subject, which is closest to my heart. And somewhere in all of that, I encountered the Bhagavad Gita as a scripture that I would read and learn the Sanskrit verses. And I found it so incredibly relevant, and it was so fascinating to me that this is a scripture that was written thousands of years ago, and the symbolism of Arjuna on the battlefield and Krishna as the guru consciousness guiding him through that battle. You know, there's many, many discussions that take place about why did Vyas, who's the writer of the Bhagavad Gita, use war as his metaphor, because it's very provocative. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have taken issue with the fact that Vyas has used war as a metaphor. Well, I'll call it a metaphor. The Gita is actually a historical work, and it's part of a greater scripture called the Mahabharata. Mm-hmm. So the Gita is 18 chapters describing the predicament of Arjuna in the middle of the battlefield, wanting to know what to do and not knowing how to act. And this isn't just, you know, a normal run-of-the-mill person of the time. Arjuna was one of the most esteemed warriors of his time and a very, very excellent human being and really, really cultured and established in all of the virtues of the time. And being virtuous was very, very highly regarded in those days. So Arjuna exemplified everything, and yet, despite the fact that he's like the most exemplary representative of humanity, finds himself in a situation that even he can't deal with. So I love that, because everyone I meet finds themselves at some point in a situation in their life that they can't deal with, that mm-hmm. they don't have the resources that have been provided for them or that they've practiced up to that time. Everyone encounters something where they're so challenged they just cannot use their normal resources that they normally use to normally get through a challenge, and they don't know what to do.
So would this be kind of like the crisis that, you know, in many spiritual traditions is considered a positive thing or a blessing because it opens you up? Would this be what that metaphor is, the crisis that one asks larger questions and looks a little deeper?
Yeah, I definitely think that that's true, that it's neat that you use the word crisis, which we usually think of as some sort of emergency and something to panic about, right? but a crisis just is a breaking point mm-hmm. into something vaster. Mm-hmm. And the ability to deal with that, what you're calling crisis, comes through the voice of Krishna.
Right.
So, and there's so much that he does to guide Arjun, A, in the field of action, but also to go even more deeply into what is it that created that sense of crisis in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And there you get into the fact that a human being has normally experiences just three states of consciousness: waking, dream, and deep sleep. And it's in the waking state of consciousness and a little bit in the dream state, but it's in the waking state of consciousness that a person experiences the waking state functioning of mind, which is dualistic.
Mm-hmm.
So if all of your resources to deal with your life situations and your mind are based in the waking state functioning of the mind, which is dualistic, how are you going to get to the resolution of the crisis, which is oneness, through mm-hmm. using means which are only available to you in the state of duality?
Mm-hmm. I see. Very, very interesting. You've touched on a very essential part of all of yoga.
Yeah.
Right there. But let's just put that on hold for a moment.
Sure.
And before we get into this a little bit more, I want to ask, now, having studied the Gita for so long and having, you know, it's very close to your heart, how is it a part of your personal sadhana? Do you chant certain verses, or do you read it every day, or how is it used in your personal mm-hmm. sadhana?
Yes, I definitely use it as a central part of my personal sadhana. I do chant verses, and there are whole chapters that I sometimes sing. And actually, for many years, I was taking some of the English translation that I use that is very inspiring to me, and I would find a verse that really inspired me, and I would turn the English translation into a song. I'm a musician, so
right.
I would turn the English translation into a song, and that would become a way of actually living the meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. And also I would have to spend time sitting and figuring out what chords I was going to use and what tune, and then using my poetry background to turn it into something that sounded more like a poem. So, you know, it used a lot of things that I already have a propensity towards,
mm-hmm.
But keeps me focused on that thought. So that's one thing that I've done over many, many years. And then studied often the word-for-word meaning of the verses, gotten together with friends who also loved the Gita and had, you know, numerous, numerous discussions about it. And then even just in my own personal life, remembering the symbolism of Krishna and Arjuna and thinking of so many things that Krishna says to Arjuna and how incredibly relevant it is. I mean, I find that just so phenomenal. It is so relevant to transform the limitation of the waking state functioning of the mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. And you mentioned the word dualism. So can we understand exactly what that means, maybe with some examples, mm-hmm. and understand what the opposite is, and
mm-hmm.
And also if you can explain a little bit about the dream and the sleeping state.
Sure. So as I said before, a human being lives in three states of consciousness, kind of flipping back and forth from waking state to dream state to deep sleep state. And in deep sleep, a person's mind is settled. Mm-hmm. There, you would never ask a person what they were thinking in deep sleep or ask them what problems they experienced in deep sleep, or even what joy they experienced in deep sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So the state of deep sleep is often used as a closest type of example to the space of non-dualism that I'm going to get to in a minute.
Okay.
But using that as a ground, in deep sleep, everyone has had the experience that they are neither happy nor sad. They neither experience pain nor joy. They don't experience any pairs of opposites. They don't experience up or down. They don't even have a sense of their name or even where they're located, you know? And nobody pays attention to it because most people say it's nothing,
mm-hmm.
so, which is what the waking state mind says about deep sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So, having said that, so from that ground of deep sleep, when consciousness starts to move, then you have dream state coming out of deep sleep. And in dream state, a person does experience happiness and unhappiness. A person does experience pairs of opposites, but it's short-lived. You wake up in the morning, and whether you had a dream that you didn't like, then you can be relieved that it's over. And if you had a dream that you liked, then you can be pleased. You'll also be disappointed because it's also over.
Mm-hmm.
So we like the dream state, actually, in the study of yoga philosophy, because it also becomes a metaphor for how everything is temporary.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter what you experience in the dream state, whether it's favorable or unfavorable to you, it always has a beginning and an end.
Mm-hmm.
So now we move into the waking state.
Mm-hmm.
And the waking state is what we consider in yoga philosophy, because that is where a person experiences a continuity of the sense of duality. So they wake up and it's much more solid, and it's felt much more solidly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why people are uncomfortable and reach that, even that point of crisis that you were mentioning earlier. So in the waking state, a person, the very description of the waking state is the sense of duality.
And now, duality, do we mean a separation or boundary between me and my world and me and other people? Or how exactly can we understand duality more in a more tangible way?
Yeah. Yes, separation between me and my world and me and other people.
Mm-hmm.
And separation between even me and myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm divided, right? And I'm dividing myself all the time. Now, if I'm more aware, I'm going to feel the effect of this division, and it's not going to feel good to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that begs the question, why? Why isn't it going to feel good to me? If the nature of the waking state is dualistic, and that's where I spend most of my time, why should it be a problem that I experience the waking state's functioning? So, because I am not limited, my real I,
mm-hmm.
is not limited to the waking state functioning, the dream state functioning, and the deep sleep state functioning. So all three experiences in all three different states,
mm-hmm.
are different functionings of consciousness, but the experiencer that exists throughout all three states is one. So you wouldn't say that it's a different Farah who experiences deep sleep, a different Farah who dreams, and a different Farah who wakes up.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And I'm saying Farah, but it's not really Farah. it's even subtler than the attribute of Farah. It's just you. I'm going to call it you, the experiencer or the knower.
Mm-hmm.
Now that isn't limited by any of the three states of consciousness.
I see. So it's the idea that we're limited that places limits and creates a dualistic kind of thinking. It's the idea.
Yes, it is the idea.
A limited idea.
It's a limited idea, but you're also dealing with a very specific functioning. Like the way my senses in my nervous system work is to apprehend what they call reality through that same sense of duality.
Mm-hmm.
So if I look at you, you look like you're a separate person sitting across from me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because my eyes see that way. And everything that my eyes perceive, they perceive as separate.
Mm-hmm.
So I immediately, without thinking, will conclude you're separate, which is what you said before. It's true. So I'll say you're separate from me. And I'll say, and I will conclude you're separate from me based on the vision of the eyes and the way they function.
And that way of seeing, that point of view, is not one that is a harmonious point of view.
Well, no. And it's a point of view that is actually erroneous, because it's not actually true that you're separate from me sitting over there.
So the way that we see through our senses, is not necessarily a correct way of seeing.
It isn't a correct way of seeing.
Okay.
It is a correct way of seeing through the ahankar, which is a word that that is interesting,
mm-hmm.
Which means the ego consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So the sense of I, as identified with the body, is there to protect the body.
Mm-hmm.
And everything and all of the functioning of the senses all refers back to the original default position of the I in the body, which is the ahankar. Now, yoga philosophy and what we're talking about as we're moving through the states of consciousness is the possibility of realizing a state of consciousness that isn't bound by the functioning of the deep sleep state, waking state, or dream state.
So this,
and that state is free from ahankar. And that state is free from the sense of crisis, which is the experience of the dichotomy that a human being feels when he feels like, I seem to be bound in these three states, but I also feel like I know something else, and that I'm not that.
So are you saying, when you say that the consciousness is not bound by the body, that we have the ability to experience ourselves as more than just what we think we are?
Absolutely.
So this dialogue is all about how to achieve that level of consciousness.
Exactly. And that is Arjuna's predicament. So I had said earlier that Krishna understands that Arjuna's predicament isn't actually based on his situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? So Arjuna comes to his guru and he says, Guruji, I have a problem. I have to fight these people and I don't want to do it. And that's my situation. You help me. I'm
mm-hmm.
simplifying, but that's basically, it's very, very form-oriented,
mm-hmm.
right? And but he's experiencing overwhelming feelings, right? It says in chapter one, he's overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And so he drops his weapons and he sinks into the back of his chariot and he says, I will not fight. And that's the end of the first chapter,
mm-hmm.
right? And Krishna, now, any other normal person would say, oh, you poor thing, you seem to be so upset, and here, have a coffee, or here, have an antidepressant, or here, try yoga, or here, do this or that. And actually, Krishna doesn't say any of that. One of his first words to him are, you pretend to be a wise person, but you speak like a fool.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts right away not giving any credibility to Arjuna's waking state mind.
Uh-huh. So he doesn't even affirm that there is a crisis.
That's correct.
And that non-affirmation is a way of poking a hole in his viewpoint.
Beautiful, exactly. I would say that's correct as a teaching method, but as Krishna, who is living a state of consciousness that we're calling the fourth state, because it isn't...
Is that Turiya?
That's Turiya. And that runs through the other three.
Okay.
So what I'll say here is that from the perspective mm-hmm. of that fourth state of consciousness, all forms of the world, all forms of the ego, all forms that were previously known as dualistic are now known as nothing but pure consciousness.
Mm-hmm. And the dualistic would correspond to, say, in other spiritual paths would be samsara. I suppose.
Yeah, and samsara is world.
Mm-hmm.
So world and mental functioning are synonymous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
Right?
Yes.
So because, again, if we go back to deep sleep, when mental functioning isn't happening, there is no world.
Yes.
Right? The entire universe could blow up when you're in deep sleep and you wouldn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you woke up and then maybe heard a sound or saw something.
Okay, this is very interesting. Let's talk a little bit about... I once heard that this sense of I, or the sense of me, the way that we limit ourselves, is at the root of all our negative emotions towards other people.
Correct.
For example, when we're disappointed or we have expectation or we're frustrated, there's a sense of I that is offended by some action.
Yeah.
So how does eliminating this sense of limitation also eliminate all other, we could say, mental afflictions or all other kinds of suffering that we have in our mind?
Yeah. That's a big question. We could do we could do a lot of interviews about just that topic. But the root of all affliction, as you call it, is the ahankar or the ego.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that is that in reality, and I mean reality the way I mean it, that
ultimate reality.
In ultimate reality, there is no ahankar.
Mm-hmm.
It's an illusion. It's a false appearance of, it's a false appearance and a false apparent reflection of the ultimate I.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I call myself to be I the ahankar or I the ego, then everything that comes after that is going to be incorrect about me.
Mm-hmm.
So the correction, which is a big part of what's happening with Krishna and Arjun, is that the correction of his placement of his unconscious placement of his I is what is happening with Krishna over and over again. That's why he starts off by not even acknowledging
mm-hmm.
the false I. And he says, you think that these people are going to die. You think you're born and you're going to die. That is not the truth about you. Now, this is extremely radical knowledge as against the knowledge that we are brought up with in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're born and you're told that you are a person who was born and that the progression of your life is moving towards an end, which is called death.
Mm-hmm.
And of course,
if you identify with the body, then of course, when the body goes, you would consider that a death.
That's right. That sense, which accepts appearance and disappearance, is called the sense of birth and death.
Mm-hmm.
Now that applies to so much in the waking state as well. So the sense of birth and death also is integral to the ahankar or the ego mechanism. Becoming egolessness or free from the ego means becoming free from the fear of death. And this is Arjun's crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Neither does he want to kill, nor does he want to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that a person experiences starting from their ahankar is based on A, the belief in birth and death, and B, the fear of death.
This is very interesting. So it's not a, you could say that the ultimate wisdom would not be to, for example, help a person find happiness from not being sad or find happiness from not being fear, but to actually overcome the sense of the root of all of it.
Beautiful.
It's a very difficult thing to grasp.
Yeah.
Because it...
because you're, if you're trying to grasp it with your waking state intellect, it can't grasp it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it is what you are. So when you hear it and it rings true, then you have to be sure that the one to whom it rings true is already your enlightened eye.
Mm-hmm.
The one who has doubt about it will never know.
Mm-hmm.
So the knowledge, though there is a huge part of the teaching, let's say between Krishna and Arjuna, where Krishna deals with Arjuna's mind
mm-hmm.
as a teacher,
mm-hmm.
and you can read the entire Gita just as a kind of tool for seeing how does Krishna actually teach Arjuna,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? But in his teaching, the effectiveness of his teaching is because there is no separation in Krishna. So he's not mm-hmm. a teacher and Arjuna's a student. Arjuna is him.
Mm-hmm.
Arjuna is exactly the same I as he is, only Krishna is enlightened of that fact, and Arjuna isn't.
Uh-huh.
And Arjuna suffers only because of lack of enlightenment about that fact, which Krishna has. But he wants that.
Mm-hmm.
He knows it's possible, and he knows that Krishna is the one who can give him that knowledge. That's to Arjuna's credit.
So what you're saying is the state of being of Krishna is what is effectively the teaching.
Yeah.
His state of oneness.
Yeah.
Okay. One thing that I think is related to this that maybe has a little more tangible concept that can help get to that is that this concept of surrender. So how can we understand how when we surrender, it's a way of erasing or dissolving that sense of I that grasps on and shows up in our body as something very solid?
Well, you seem to have described it really well. So how do you mean, how can we understand?
Or can you give some examples of what it means to surrender? Like when either a problem shows up in our life
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or when we're actually doing actions.
Mm-hmm.
What does it look like?
Right. Well, so the opposite of surrender would be holding on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Attaching, being attached, the state of being attached again to your sense of I am just a body.
Mm-hmm. Well, and does it also apply to emotions, like being attached to...
Absolutely, absolutely. And so, let's say, to use your example, you're experiencing some difficulty in your life, like Arjuna is,
mm-hmm.
right? And Krishna keeps saying, surrender to me,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
Surrender, at one point, later on, he says, give your mind to me and let me do everything,
mm-hmm.
right? Just don't worry, I'm going to take care of everything. And he keeps saying that, I'm already doing everything.
Mm-hmm.
You think you're doing it. But I'm already, that itself is false, right? Is the idea that you actually are a separate person doing actions. So all, the source of all action is not available to be known by the waking state mind.
the source of all action. So would that refer to karma?
I would say even deeper than karma is a an unseen wellspring of consciousness energy. In Gita, it's called Krishna. In religion, it's called God. In metaphysics, it might be called space.
Okay.
So that cosmic energy, that universal being, that highest self, is actually at the source of everything.
Uh-huh.
But the functioning of the waking state mind in duality, as I described, the way it moves through the eyes and through the senses, it cannot know the source unless it undertakes a transformation of moving the consciousness and the attention inward rather than outward.
Okay, so one of the ways to practice surrender would be to start to work on drawing the senses inward.
Right.
Because that would be where we can get in touch with
right.
this underlying essence or this underlying source.
Right. Now, first you have to accept that who you are as a body and what your actions are and even what your thinking is all coming from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And who thinks about that? Where is it coming from? And often if you ask someone where is it coming from, they'll point to their body and say, it's coming from me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But you know that if that same power, which is giving life to the body and enlivening the thinking and the emotions and the actions, if that power by its own free will decides to withdraw itself from the body, then who can act, who can think, and who can feel?
So would that be like what is it that makes the heart beat?
Yeah,
like what it,
that's right. What is it that allows you to breathe in every moment?
Mm-hmm.
Because you know that at your final moment, the breath is withdrawn.
Mm-hmm.
So the breath giver is our source. The thought giver is our source. The feeling giver is our source. Remembering that is surrender.
Huh.
It won't easily happen for a person because a person isn't wired or designed in the waking state to remember the source. The very birth of a human being equals forgetfulness of the source.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nobody's fault. And that's a really, really important thing, is that it's not nobody did it. It's not your fault. You didn't create the separation from the source. Separation, sense of separation from the source comes by birth. Now, if you are an intelligent, aware person like Arjun, you start to feel that it is insufficient to feel separate from your source, and you start to ask questions,
mm-hmm.
right? And that sense of inquiry becomes the thread of your attention to lead you to the connection with the source.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, you're never disconnected from that source.
Mm-hmm. So it's remembering.
It's remembering and it's offering. So that's what I would also add to your idea of surrender when you said, how can a person
mm-hmm.
surrender? Often, if I notice something going on in my life or in my thinking and I don't know what to do, just like Arjun, right? So I'll offer it. So mm-hmm. either in my meditation, in my thinking, it will be an intentional, conscious offering to the space, to the source, to that which I cannot see. You take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
You guide me. I've noticed it works. What you have to be prepared for is that there's that interim which people are uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm. You know, the gap.
Right? After you've offered it, you know, it's like you're used to hanging on and feeling like you're in control. All of which, that sense of feeling like you're in control, belongs to the ego mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you feel something, often that becomes the point of crisis for a person, is that suddenly they realize they're not as in control as they had perhaps thought they were. Mm-hmm. That doesn't feel very good, right?
Right.
So now it begs the question, okay, what do I do with this sense of extreme discomfort about the fact that I don't feel like I'm in control?
Mm-hmm.
There you can bring in your technique of surrender. So you look like you're developing a relationship with your higher self, but that would be incorrect because it's not a relationship, it's what you are.
Mm-hmm.
You're including it
mm-hmm.
in your consciousness, which otherwise, unless you intentionally include it, offer, and surrender, which means you offer your sense of small self to your own higher self.
And that relationship probably is, or that way of thinking about it is useful until the small self is completely gone, and there's only anything else but.
That's right. That's exactly right. And to me, that is the supreme technique, the supreme event, the supreme goal of all sadhana, all spiritual practice, is this ultimate surrender of the individual I or the ahankar into its own source, and the recognition thereby that I was never separate, I was never alone, you know, I was never any of those, and all of my emotions and feelings and all of my situations and happenings and all of my sense of birth and death and all of my fear of change and trying to cope with the challenging situations in my life, it's all not separate from that self.
Mm-hmm. So let's now try to think about, for people who live in this area or live in a modern city.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the beginning of the interview, you mentioned it's such a relevant text. So this metaphor that Arjun is in, what is the metaphor that we're in today? And how does this duality and separation play out in today's, in the 21st century?
Yeah. So the metaphor that Arjun represents is he, as you, I liked your word, crisis. So he's at a turning point in his life. He's facing a very, very challenging situation. And, you know, I look around, and especially, it's been 3 years since I've been in Canada, and there have been big changes in 3 years, and I notice a much more pervasive sense of uncertainty,
mm-hmm.
Bordering on even a bit of fear,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Uncertainty is a good word. Uncertainty and unsettledness.
Mm-hmm.
People don't know what's coming next,
mm-hmm.
and are struggling often, not always, but there are often struggling just to keep up with the pace or rate of change that seems to be happening in their daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Arjun is dealing with the same predicament,
mm-hmm.
right? He's suddenly faced with a situation that has seriously changed for him, and he doesn't know what to do. And I think that's what happens. You know, you're given a certain training in your life, and that training is supposed to prepare you to be a grown-up and deal with your challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hit some of those challenges and your training isn't kicking in to help you.
Mm-hmm. Even the training of having a physical yoga practice.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly Arjun's predicament. As I said, he's not just any human being. He's a very, very exemplary human being.
Mm-hmm.
And if even he right, is finding it challenging to deal with his situation, then it makes the reader sort of sit up and take notice that, wow, like, this guy, who's Arjun, right,
mm-hmm.
isn't knowing what to do. And Vyas, who's the writer of the Gita, clearly tuned into some cosmic sort of archetypal situation for human beings, because Arjun's situation, though cloaked in the cultural happening of that time, so he's on a battlefield having to fight a battle of virtue for his family.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the cultural aspect. But the metaphorical aspect is that he's on a battlefield. Mm-hmm. And the battlefield, the Kurukshetra, which is the name of the battlefield where the battle was fought, the battlefield is his own mind. Mm-hmm. And he is incapable of dealing with the challenge that is being presented to him by his dualistic waking state mind, even though he has been trained from birth to be the most excellent warrior. He's from the Kshatriya class, which is the warrior class, mm-hmm. right? So again, he's born into it, he's been trained into it, and he's been prepared for this. Mm-hmm. So it's not a small thing that he just sort of wimps out and drops his bow and arrow and says, I won't fight. Mm-hmm. And Vyas, the writer of the Gita, understood that this scenario that he's painting represents the eternal human predicament. Therefore, it's as relevant in the 21st century as it was in whatever century this Bhagavad Gita was written, which is before Christ. Mm-hmm. So now what we're dealing with is human consciousness, mm-hmm. which throughout the ages, though apparently changing with culture and time and the progression of history and all of that sort of thing, the actual functioning of human consciousness and its potential for realization of my own self as pure and free and eternal has always been. Mm-hmm. So it's like the canvas, you know, the backdrop on which all the different scenarios of that consciousness play out. And I believe and feel that the Gita represents that, that there's always, always a higher consciousness that is available to us. And the dialogue between Krishna and Arjun is the dialogue that is taking place in our own heads. You've got Arjun, who doesn't know what to do, who represents ignorance, and you've got Krishna, the voice that says, no, I can do this. No, you aren't actually limited, right? Mm-hmm. You can act, and you can break through the limitation of your waking state. Mm-hmm. So that Krishna consciousness is less accessible and even inaccessible to most people.
Now, that's, I'm sure, a topic for a whole nother interview. But one question I want to come back to in terms of surrender is, I myself have a teacher or guru, as it's known, and I find it really useful to have a physical person who I can think of when I have problems,
yeah.
or when I have, when I'm in a state of crisis or in a state of duality. So, how important is it to have some, at least, image of something higher, or to have a concept, or to actually have a person, and what is the function of that in helping, mm-hmm. In the sense of surrender?
Yeah. It's a beautiful question. It's extremely important. It's important because, again, going back to our Gita, the way this whole unfoldment of Arjun's realization of the self takes place is through his dialogue with his teacher. Mm-hmm. And Krishna, it's like in physics, you've got those subatomic particles that sometimes behave like a particle and sometimes behave like a wave. You can't pin them down. Mm-hmm. But Krishna's like that, mm-hmm. right? He is the absolute, like in chapter 11, when he reveals his divine form to Arjun, it becomes obvious that he's not just the chum that Arjun thought he was, which is like the particle, right? He's the wave. He's the whole consciousness. He's mm-hmm. vaster than vast. Mm-hmm. And the miracle is that vaster than vast can also manifest itself through its own form as a human being. Mm-hmm. And it's not separate. Mm-hmm. So in whatever way that vaster than vast or subtler than subtlest manifests itself in your life, it is to be surrendered to because it's your own vaster than vast.
Mm-hmm. And that could be, I suppose, through a person or even through an experience in nature or
that's right and anyone who's had an experience of something bigger has what accompanies that experience is always a sense of doubtlessness. Mm-hmm. You know, you just know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You just know that this is something, you know, this is just so true, mm-hmm. and that this is what is real. Mm-hmm. Until the mind kicks in again and starts doubting, because that's its job, right? So, which Arjun represents that. So something needs to be there as an ideal. That's what I think you're referring to. Mm-hmm. So that the mind, and even if you're just making a concept of it, mm-hmm. right? You just keep following, then it's like Hansel and Gretel, right? You just keep following the breadcrumbs.
Right.
The next thing, because I'm aware that not everyone has a physical teacher. Mm-hmm. And so if you speak about the necessity for a physical teacher, then anyone who doesn't have a physical teacher is going to feel bad. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I don't want them to feel bad. Mm-hmm. So I will say that it is fortunate if you have a physical teacher, and yet the ways of that infinite vast being are so creative that that teacher can come to you when you are open. It will show up in your life, mm-hmm. and your whole life becomes your teacher. Mm-hmm. So the spirit with which you approach your life, which then goes back to our theme of surrender, because if you can recognize with whatever concept you make that there is a higher being than you as an ahankar or an ego consciousness, if you can recognize that and accept that, then a lot of the job is done. Mm-hmm. And if you can practice that in every moment, then you're not doing. Mm-hmm. Then that, because here's what happens. Here's the magic of what happens through surrender. Through surrender, the false barrier between yourself and that higher being gets dissolved. So what you're effectively doing is you're taking down your umbrella so that the grace can shower on you. It's not like grace is only going to shower, you know, when those particular experiences happen. Grace is always showering, mm-hmm. but we fail to recognize it because of the ahankar.
Mm-hmm. That's, you know, I that's such a beautiful metaphor, and I think that'll be a perfect way for us to draw this particular interview in our series to an end, is to think of the umbrella as the ahankar, and when you remove it, that grace can then shower you. So
yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time, and I look forward to our continued dialogues about the Bhagavad Gita.
So do I. Thanks so much.